Hello and welcome to the Scholar Circle. I'm Maria Armudian. In this hour, why did soldiers on the front lines of one of the deadliest wars lay down their arms and play soccer with the very men they were supposed to shoot? We'll revisit the Christmas Truce of 1914. Then, the value of nothing, a new idea to reshape markets and society. Finally, how does the design of a city and its architecture affect democracy, community, our psychology, and public health? World War I was one of the deadliest periods in human history, but it was also the time of one of the most profound, impromptu expressions of humanity. Tens of thousands of soldiers on the front lines laid down their arms, exchanged gifts, songs, and makeshift soccer balls in what became known as the Christmas Truce. How did the peace come about? And what do the historic events tell us about humanity? Stanley Weintraub joins us now. He's a professor emeritus at Pennsylvania State University, a historian and author. His more than 50 books include Silent Night, the story of the World War I Christmas Truce. Welcome, Stanley Weintraub.
Glad to be with you.
I thought perhaps we should start with a little bit of context of what was going on during World War I in 1914 before the Christmas Truce.
We have to think that Christmas was not on the minds of soldiers on either side in mid-December 1914. The weather was cold, rain just above freezing. Where the Christmas Truce began was in Flanders, the area of Belgium, France, just below the North Sea and the English Channel, where the land was actually below sea level, held in by dikes and bulwarks and seawalls. They were living in miserable conditions because everything was muddy. The troops on both sides had dug in trenches. There was a stalemate that had taken place just after the bad weather began in late November. They were living in terrible shape. The trenches were flooded, cold rain and mud had made things worse. Unless soldiers in mucky hideaways stayed awake, they could drown, quite literally sinking into the liquefying mud. Many slept erect where they could. It was very difficult to accomplish one's bodily functions or sleep or eat under those conditions. And so there was not much fighting. It was a matter of live and let live until the weather got better. And it was under those conditions that the Christmas Truce began. A German soldier who later became a famous artist named Otto Dix was on the front lines, and he described the landscape as lice, rats, barbed wire, fleas, bombs, underground caves, corpses, blood, liquor, mice, cats, artillery, filth, bullets, mortars, fire, steel. That's what war is, he said. It's the work of the devil. So under those conditions, it was a live-and-let-live situation until something happened that made a Christmas truce Christmassy. And that began on both sides independently. The British, during the Boer War, that is the war in South Africa in 1899-1900, had sent brass Christmas boxes to the troops thousands of miles away, figuring that they'd be lonely and unhappy that far away. And Queen Victoria, in her last years, arranged for this. These were small brass boxes filled basically with chocolates, and the troops loved getting them. Some of them claimed that having them in their pockets actually stopped bullets. But in any cases, in 1914, military people remembered doing this and decided, let's do it again. And so they prepared brass Christmas boxes to send across the North Sea to Belgium and Flanders for their troops, basically, again, containing chocolates, in some cases other kinds of goodies. The Germans got wind of this, and they prepared wooden boxes pretty much the same size, pretty much like 3x5, and they put in them sausages and typically German goodies and cigars and cigarettes, and these were sent to the troops. But the Germans had something else they could do that the British couldn't. The Germans originated the idea of the Christmas tree, and their idea was the tabletop Christmas tree, not the big monsters that we have over here. The Christmas trees could be brought into the front lines quite literally by the Germans because they, after all, had a ground connection to Germany, which the British didn't. The British had to cross the water for it. And so the Germans brought in Christmas trees and had them already fixed with candles attached. Lighting candles would have been a serious mistake in the front lines, but the Germans decided they'd do so anyway. After all, there was this live and let peace, and they take a chance that the bullets might fly. And on the bulwarks of their trenches, many German soldiers propped up the Christmas trees and lit the candles and waited to see what would happen. In some cases, there were some shots fired at them. In most cases, the British were intensely curious as to what was going on across the front lines only 60 or 70 yards away. You have to remember that the distances between the enemies was actually shorter than the length of a football field, but they were separated by trenches and by very bad weather and by bulwarks above the trenches. The British actually crawled out into no man's land, the area between the trenches, to see what was going on. And the Germans, seeing that, crawled out too. And pretty soon there was some camaraderie in the middle of the night on Christmas Eve. There began the actual Christmas truce.
I wanted to back up because, as I understood from your book, this actually did begin perhaps mid-December, a few weeks out.
There were a few cases about the 19th of December, in other words, about a week before Christmas, when this live and let live policy in that bad weather resulted in temporary cessations of shooting so both sides could retrieve their wounded and their dead and bury the dead. And they got to know each other that way, and they discovered that they were people like themselves. You can demonize the enemy from far away, but you can't demonize your enemy when the enemy is close up, especially when they look like you. And this is one of the reasons why we haven't had Christmas truces before or since. In most cases, the Christmas truce, which was unique in 1914, couldn't happen because of the cultural differences, the cultural distances, in fact. After all, I spent two Christmases in Korea during the Korean War myself as a young officer. The North Koreans and the Chinese weren't interested in Christmas. That wasn't their holiday. We could not have had a Christmas truce on the front lines. This couldn't have happened in World War II fighting the Japanese. It couldn't have happened with the Nazis who didn't believe in Christmas in World War II. So this was a very unusual situation when both sides loved Christmas trees and Christmas gifts and sang Christmas carols and looked like each other.
I thought there were very many interesting occurrences in your book that describe what was going on. There was one particular time about a week before Christmas when the Germans ostensibly slipped a chocolate cake into the British lines with an invitation to a concert.
They said it was their captain's birthday, and they were going to have a concert for him, and the British could listen. They weren't Christmas carols, but this was something that had happened in an earlier war, the idea of a concert given by another side. During the Civil War, there were occasions when North and South had trumpet competitions across the lines. They had cornets and trumpets and bands. Now, they didn't really meet, but there was this musical competition. In World War I, at least in the first year of the war, the two sides on Christmas Eve sang to each other. The Germans began it singing Silent Night, and although they sang it in German, the tune was familiar to the British. They sang it too in their own language. Songs went back and forth between the sides during the darkness of Christmas Eve, and pretty soon there was competition again. The Germans had a singer from the Berlin Opera named Walter Kirchhoff, who was called on to sing, and he sang Christmas carols very lustily across the trenches. It sounds unbelievable, but when you realize there was less than the length of a football field between them, and they were bogged down in rain and mud and unlikely to try to advance or fire, it's easy to see how this could happen. The French hated the Germans because in 1870, the Germans had warred on the French and taken the provinces of Alsace and Lorraine away from the French. Theoretically, they weren't going to have any Christmas truce, and censorship claimed that they didn't, but the French sent out a singer from the Paris Opera who sang to the Germans O Holy Night. And so there was a very strange, almost dreamlike atmosphere that was beginning to permeate both lines.
So there actually says something about two things here. One is, as you mentioned, the demonization of somebody who's right in front of you, which is a little bit harder to do. It also speaks about this kind of shared cultural connection, but it's also the power of music.
The power of music certainly had a lot to do with it. The British were far more interested in singing bawdy songs to the Germans which they did, and I quote several of them in my book. The Germans were amused by it and knew English. This was, again, one of the unusual factors. Many of the Germans had actually worked in England before the war. They had had jobs as barbers and taxi drivers and waiters and other kinds of jobs that didn't require a good deal of schooling, but they learned English. And their officers and some other senior people in their lines learned English in school. The British didn't learn German, but the Germans learned English. And they could speak to the British, and they could exchange jabs at them and sing at them. So there was a cultural mix that couldn't have occurred in any other wars. One thing they wanted to do, as they had done before, was bury the dead. They could get together more closely if they could cross their lines, which were pockmarked by shell holes filled with water and also blocked by corpses that had been there for quite a long time. They wanted to bury them. And somebody got the idea, which spread across the lines, we could play football in daylight if we had a clear area. And so they agreed that after dawn, they would get together between the lines, they'd fill in the shell holes, and they'd bury the dead. And they did in many areas in the 300-mile length of the front lines from the North Sea to the Swiss border. And that meant the Belgians and the British and the French and the Germans on the other side, who included Austrians and Bavarians, who were far more peaceful-minded than the Prussians on the German side. And they did bury the dead in joint ceremonies. Their chaplains came out and officiated. And they did actually play soccer, football in their language. At first, I didn't believe this happened. I had read little bits about the Christmas truce, and many historians said, well, this, of course, was legendary. And the whole idea that they could have played football is quite mythic. But I looked it up in the Imperial War Museum in London and in archives in Germany and in letters sent by the troops. And certainly they played football. They described it very accurately. They used improvised balls and goals. And their official documents, the company diaries kept, even had the scores.
And so who won?
The Germans won most of the games. And they were very proud of that. But the important thing was that they were able to get together on Christmas Day and pretend that there was no war going on between them.
Here we have these soldiers on the front lines laying their weapons down and fraternizing with the other side, despite the fact that it's a court-martial offense.
But you see, they had gifts they could give out. They had their Christmas boxes, and they had other presents sent from home. The British were loaded up with presents because the newspapers had publicized the fact that the troops need gifts. And they were loaded up with mince pies and other such things. The Germans had never seen a mince pie, and the British were glad to get rid of a lot of them. There was a lot of trading back and forth. And in one case, I found a German had traded his helmet, the Tickelhaube with the horn-like device at the top of the helmet, to a British soldier. And a day later, he came back to the soldier and said, we're going to have an inspection. I need to borrow it back. The British had no helmets yet. It would be 2 years into the war before they had steel helmets. They traded food. They traded various kinds of equipment. And they mixed together. And they did so until the German higher-ranking officers and the Allied higher-ranking officers began to be concerned. After all, there's no war if the soldiers don't fight. You've got to get them back to fighting again. And they actually managed to do so. It wasn't easy, because once you meet your friends who are the enemy and you see them face to face, it's hard to fight them again. One soldier actually met his former barber, who's German, and he said, you need a back and sides, sit down and I'll take care of that. And he trimmed his hair on the front lines. What do you do under such circumstances? They sang together. They ate together. The only thing they could do from the higher up angle was to move them out. In other words, to replace them with reserves who had been indoctrinated to hate. And so they pulled out many of the troops on the front lines and after Christmas replaced them with other troops and forced them to fire again.
Just a quick reminder that you are listening to The Scholar Circle. I'm Maria Armudian, and we're speaking with Stanley Weintraub about the historic impromptu ceasefire of World War I, known as the Christmas Truce. You described this as everywhere you looked, people were talking and playing. How many of the front lines really were engaged?
It depended on the commanding officers involved. There were areas where there was no fighting, and there were areas where the senior officers said, I order you under pain of court-martial to keep fighting. And so some of them had to shoot. When they did, they generally shot high up in the air over the heads of the troops opposite them. They refused to have actual fighting go on. I found a number of instances of this where the junior officers on both sides would go out into no man's land and meet, and they would say, we're being forced to fire again. We'll fire high up in the air. We'll send a flare up to let you know, and then you can go into hiding or into your trenches. They did this in very surprising ways. Often they exchanged gifts. A German would exchange his gloves for a British scarf, for example, and then they'd go back and they'd fire a flare. A few hours later, the fighting would resume. In some cases, it lasted into New Year's, not because they were celebrating New Year's Day, but because the weather was still so bad.
One of the instances that you described in your book was when a French person warned the Germans to, quote, be on guard tomorrow. A general is coming to visit our position. For reasons of shame and honor, we will have to fire.
And of course they did. But there were some very strange things that occurred that are almost unbelievable. Soldiers would write home about them and talk about them as if they were a waking dream. And I researched this over the years by going to the British newspaper library in North London in Colindale and reading the letters to the editor in provincial newspapers where soldiers had written to their wives and girlfriends and parents and said, you won't believe what has just happened, and went on to describe the meetings between the two sides and the fraternization. The newspapers were sent these by the people who received those letters, and they printed them. So I found literally hundreds of such letters, both in Germany and in England, that were printed before censorship began.
You mentioned the media's response, and it sounded from what you found in your research that there was considerable resistance in mass media, other than these letters, to treat this as important as you see it as, like they really downplayed it. What is your assessment of this?
The managements of the newspapers were trying to be ultra-patriotic, and they didn't like this idea, but the pressure for such news was terrific. In one case, a German juggler who had performed in England came out and performed his juggling act between the trenches. There were all kinds of episodes like this that, as the soldiers said, seemed like a waking dream. But a dream doesn't last. You wake up, and you wake up to reality. And the war began again, and there would never be another Christmas truce in military history.
And do you think we never have another Christmas truce in military history, partly because the leaders who you made very clear this is war is being driven by the leaders, not by the soldiers, learned from this?
Well, the military leaders are a professional group. Their job is to win wars, to fight and win wars, to fight and defend one's country. And soldiers, for the most part, in a big war, are drafted. They come from the farms and the factories and other such places, and they're not professional. They have no careers dependent on winning a war, and they have to be propagandized into wanting to win a war. It's very difficult, for example, right now, to try to convince a soldier, even though he's an enlisted person in Afghanistan, that there's something very important for his own country involved in fighting and possibly dying in Afghanistan.
When you look at this in a historical context and you do put it in today's time frame, which, for example, in the Afghanistan case that you mentioned, what do you take away as the wisdom of the Christmas truce?
The wisdom of the Christmas truce is that we're all the same, and there are many reasons why we should be friends instead of enemies. And that's hard to accept if there are no cultural connections. It's hard to accept if you have the other side unwilling to admit that there is anything that you represent that is going to create friendship.
The other takeaway that I thought about is the role of leaders and the role of mass media in some cases in being able to convince people of the either reasons for the war and the demonization of the other and all of the beliefs that can arise from that. And one thing that I underlined in your book pertained to a particular leader, which was Hitler, who would not participate in the Christmas truce.
He didn't believe in Christmas, so he wouldn't participate. He hated the enemy, and the enemy didn't believe anything that he did. But you mentioned the mass media. That's a big difference now, too. The mass media during World War I, 1914, were largely the newspapers, and the newspaper owners represented, in effect, big business and therefore big government. That has become dissipated. Radio came in, television came in. I was in Korea in 1951-52 when live television existed in America, but it brought home the reality of war, what it was really like visually. That hadn't happened before. Now we have other mass media, all the electronic media, and it's very difficult to try to manipulate all of the sources of information. And so it's difficult now to develop one kind of bandwagon that everybody follows.
You pointed out in your book when the exchanges were going on prior to Christmas Eve, one of the exchanges were newspapers.
The newspapers could be exchanged because people were so close by. The Germans had land routes back home. The British actually, on their front lines, could read newspapers that were sent in that had only been printed a day or two before.
Your ultimate conclusion at the end I thought was quite beautiful. You said you conclude that the Christmas truce is a celebration of the human spirit and a moving manifestation of the absurdities of war.
But it's only true when you have cultural relationships with your enemy.
It would be interesting to see what cross-cultural relationships could generate as well. Because there are things that all humanity shares. It may not be Christmas. It may be something else.
In the past, we could go back to ancient Greece and let's say the war is described in the Iliad and find there were temporary truces to bury the dead or for some religious reason. They didn't last and the war began again. There were truces in other wars, basically again, for burying the dead and retrieving the wounded. But the cultural differences have become far greater.
The other thing that you had said was that the war continued not because the soldiers wanted to fight. In fact, the soldiers were in some ways trying to prevent their so-called enemy from being harmed. And so it was really the generals and the political leaders that then had to change the soldiers on the front line in order to continue a war.
Yeah. If you have a military defeat, your government's going to go down. If you have a military defeat, your general is going to lose his job. So a lot of this has to do with the intentions and the needs of the people who make the decisions.
And let's conclude with the counterfactuals that you started, which is, what if?
What if people refuse to fight? We've had mass demonstrations in cities and the Arab countries in North Africa, which suggest what can happen when people get out in the mass and dare their governments to do what they don't want them to do. It's possible. It's possible, but it's not easy, and it can be very costly and dangerous and harmful to the people involved.
Well, Stanley Weintraub, thank you so much. The book, again, is called Silent Night, The Story of the World War I Christmas Truce. You are listening to The Scholar Circle, scholarcircle.org. I'm Maria Armudian. Over a century ago, Oscar Wilde suggested that, quote, nowadays, people know the price of everything and the value of nothing. Our next guest says that we are blinded by prices and the so-called free market. As we've seen, the so-called market theory has not only failed, but he says it's also acted as a camouflage for activities that aren't about markets at all. Prices, he says, have little correspondence with their value or even their costs. We're joined by Raj Patel. He is the author of Stuffed and Starved and his latest book, The Value of Nothing, How to Reshape Market Society and Redefine Democracy. Welcome, Raj Patel.
Hi, Maria. Good to be here.
It's great to have you with us. Tell us about the camouflage that you think is occurring as a result of prices and markets?
It's pretty easy for us to see that in many ways, I mean, if you're concerned about climate change, if you're concerned about labor, if you're concerned about pretty much anything, the way that we're greeted with prices in the markets don't really tell us the full story about the exercises of power that it took to make the things that we're buying and selling. And if that sounds a little abstract, I mean, let's break it down to something very simple, like a hamburger. And we see a $4 hamburger in our local burger joint. But there's a lot that is hidden from us in that price. The environmental damage, for example, in making that hamburger. I mean, if the hamburger came from cows that were on pasture, that once upon a time used to be rainforest. We heard a lot in the 80s about rainforest being chopped down to make pasture for cattle. If that's where the cow came from, then some researchers in India have said a burger shouldn't cost $4, it should cost nearer $200, because in losing that rainforest, we've lost biodiversity, we've lost carbon, we've lost the oxygen being produced, and that's hidden from us in the price, as are many other things, like the real cost of labor. I mean, if this hamburger is eaten in the United States, the chances are that the tomato in that hamburger will come from southern Florida, where since 1997, over 1,000 slaves, I mean, people in conditions of modern-day slavery, have been freed from captivity. So the price of our hamburger really hides a great deal in terms of labor, in terms of environmental damage, and it doesn't even include the healthcare costs that we'll pay after consuming the hamburger.
You also talked about some manipulations. In fact, you even used Wall Street itself as an example with the Volkswagen.
Well, that's right. This is just an absurdity of the way that the trading system works on Wall Street. The biggest corporation in terms of dollar value was, for a very short time, Volkswagen, the German auto manufacturer. And that was because of a series of weird transactions behind the scenes that drove up the price of Volkswagen shares astronomically, just because of a certain sense of manipulation and then the way that markets and hedge funds worked. But, of course, there's something very systematic about the way in which Wall Street has managed to shuffle off the risks associated with its bets. And so they were able to make a great deal of money in terms of bonuses and worry about the risks coming due in the next quarter. And, of course, when those risks came due, it was us who ended up picking up the pieces and paying the tab for that.
Now, the other thing that I thought was quite interesting was the other blinding that you talked about, the camouflage, which is the cultural camouflage and how we have become trapped and blinded to certain realities. You call it Anton's blindness. Part of this is this idea about market and society and that they're separated.
We've been so soaked in this idea that the only way we can value the world around us is if we put it in a market and stick a price label on it. That we've quite forgotten how, first of all, that sticking things in markets and putting price labels on them isn't a terribly good way of valuing things, as we've already seen. But also that there are other ways of valuing the world. And I liken it in the book to a disease called Anton's blindness. Now, Anton's blindness was named after a French neurologist called Gabriel Anton. He found this condition where people were cortically blind. In other words, the signals between their eyes and their brains weren't being transmitted. So they were, in every meaningful sense, blind, except for one thing, which is that they believed that they could see. And the way that you diagnose is that when they bump into things, their brains are telling them two different things. One, they believe that they can see, but on the other hand, they've just hit a hard thing and they don't know how it got there. And so they have to tell a story. They have to confabulate to be able to reconcile these two different facts. And this confabulation is how you diagnose the disease. But it's also a metaphor for how we've been blinded by the idea that markets are the only way to go. And when markets fail, as they have so spectacularly, the only thing that we're left saying is, well, if only there'd been better regulation, or if only AIG hadn't been, quite so disastrous, things would have been okay. But what we need to do is think about ways of moving beyond these so-called free markets to other ways of valuing the world around us that can actually be a little bit more robust. But in order to ask that question, in order to get to that space, we do need to realize that actually what we believe we can see through the prism of free markets is an illusion.
And including what you say is the illusion that the market and society and the planet are separate.
Again, we're encouraged to believe that markets are these sort of God-given things, or that they are in some sense natural. And of course, they're nothing of the kind. It takes work to make markets. The example, if people want a sense of how markets are human-made, think about slavery. That there was a time when slavery was illegal, and then all of a sudden, particularly in the building of the United States, it was okay to have markets in people. But because of resistance, because of organizing, because of a range of things, it was decided then to stop having markets in people. The Civil War was fought in part about the rights of people and the limits to markets. And there's nothing natural about that, but somehow we've forgotten that markets depend on society. And of course, we've been reminded recently that free markets need society to catch them when they fall, and that's why we've assumed trillions of dollars of debt that our children will be paying off for quite some time to come.
You have also talked about other cultures and how perhaps this isn't really even natural for human beings. Cooperation, for example, is very natural, you say, in other societies. And you point out Indonesia, how the experiment where they keep 43% and give away 57%, whereas in the United States, it would be the reverse.
It is interesting that we have this idea that at heart, all human beings are wicked and selfish. And that's the way that nature has intended us. It's true that we have selfish genes, but it's not true that in order for us to survive as animals, we have to be selfish. In fact, quite the opposite is true. Through natural selection, we have become fit to survive in this environment only because not only are we selfish, but we are also capable of being cooperative, generous, and altruistic. This is a position that the Swiss philosopher Jean-Jacques Rousseau had. He understood that, yes, people are basically not terribly good, but what we also are is capable of learning to be better than purely selfish. And experiment after experiment has shown that even the most selfish people on Earth are capable of being a little bit more than purely selfish individuals. And that doesn't do a terribly good job of encouraging generosity and altruism. But there are cultures that do a much better job of that. That's something that we ought to remember. If we're going to come up with solutions about how to value resources together and how to find the real value of things other than through markets.
What I wanted to touch on was the studies of happiness and fairness and how these things reflect on people's generosity and this type of a thing. Even chimpanzees, the experiments have shown that they have a sense of fairness.
There's a range of experiments with primates, and even studies have looked at dogs and looked at how dogs that actually sort of socialize and play with others are more likely to survive than dogs that are individual and sort of try and make it by themselves as sort of solitary animals. In fact, there's a mortality rate that double if you try and be a sort of selfish dog than dogs that are able to work with others. And there are also experiments where, again, primates are sort of given an unfair situation. And if they were behaving as purely rational animals, they're confronted with an unfair situation where one of their partners is given more than they are in an exchange. And even though they had the opportunity to get at least something in the exchange, the fact that their partner got something very nice to eat and they got a cucumber, they actually threw the cucumber away because they said the primates thought that there was something very unfair about the situation. And this sense of that's not fair is something that actually we as humans also have. And this idea of fairness can trump the idea of just a selfish individual. I mean, if this animal was purely selfish, it would have taken the cucumber because a cucumber is better than nothing. But we're not wired that way. We're wired to look at others. We're wired with a sort of sense of fairness. And that's something, again, that can work for us in very positive ways.
There are two things I wanted you to address with this question. One of the questions is about how money and rights are actually related, because money buys liberty.
Oh, yes.
And money buys rights to health care, to food, to housing. You've talked about this in your book. And the other thing is how the culture itself has changed about having the right to have rights.
Yes. One of the things that we're sold is that the free markets are about liberty. Free markets give us freedom. But in a free market, of course, you're only as free as the amount of money that you have. If you have a lot of cash, then you are able to buy healthcare. You are able to feed yourself and your family. You are able to travel wherever you like and live in a house. But in the U.S. today, because so many of our rights have been ceded to the free market, there were, for example, in 2008, 49.2 million Americans who were denied the right to food. In other words, 49.2 million Americans were food insecure. And they were food insecure not because there weren't free markets, but because through free markets, the only way that they could access food was through money. And if they didn't have money, they weren't guaranteed the right to food. And so although free markets seem to be about liberties, if you have no money in a free market, then freedom is just another word for nothing that you can afford. And that idea is something that I talk about in The Value of Nothing, because if you don't have money, then effectively you don't have any right to have rights. If you don't have cash, then you don't have the right to healthcare. You don't have the right to food. And this idea of having a right to have rights is something that's really been foreclosed. We've been denied the right to have rights because the right to property has trumped everything else.
So finally, you talked a bit about in the book the peasant movement, and you've talked about what happened with the food riots, with food sovereignty. Give us a sense of what the other alternatives are.
One of the alternatives, and one that's very specifically about the right to have rights, comes from an international peasant movement called La Via Campesina, and that is a movement that has 150 million members around the world, including here in the United States. And their vision is that what we need is democracy. Democracy is kind of the way that we get to have these rights, or rather a right to have rights. Via Campesina is interested in a democratic conversation about food. But in order to have that, we need to level the inequalities in power that prevent real democracy from happening. And that means addressing the inequalities that exist not only between rich and poor countries, where, you know, rich countries have enslaved poor countries with debt, but also even within the household, where inequalities and gender relations still persist and are fundamental to the way modern society operates. And so Via Campesina have this amazing slogan that food sovereignty is about an end to all forms of violence against women. And this idea that a peasant movement could come up with an idea that in order for us to have rights, we need to start with equalizing power within the household all the way up to, you know, international levels, gives you a sense of, firstly, how big a vision this is and how much work there is to do, but also how hopeful the transformation away from the sort of market society we have at the moment to a different kind of market society can be.
Well, Raj Patel, I want to thank you so much for being with us. This has been a wonderful conversation.
Thank you so much. I've really enjoyed it.
Raj Patel is the author of The Value of Nothing, How to Reshape Market Society and Redefine Democracy. When we come back, how does the design of a city and its architecture affect democracy, community, our psychology, and public health? Stay tuned. You are listening to The Scholar Circle, scholarcircle.org. I'm Maria Armudian. Why are some cities bursting with life, beauty, and community, while others feel dangerous and isolating? Our next guest argues that it's largely in a city's design. Well-designed cities, he says, encourage vibrancy, safety, happiness for their dwellers. What are the secrets to make what he calls cities for people? Dr. Jan Gehl is a professor emeritus of urban design at the School of Architecture in Copenhagen, Denmark, and author of the book Cities for People, and he's an award-winning architect. So welcome, Jan Gehl.
Thank you very much.
The most profound aspect of what you've done in this book is this idea that architecture has these really profound psychological effects on people. One example was you talked about large spaces and tall buildings signaling a particular kind of environment, whereas small spaces like Venice, for example, signal another. Can you explain this effect and give us some more examples?
I'm speaking quite a bit about what I call human scale. And for me, human scale is based very much on how we can move, how our senses work, how we can pick up things, very small things at short distances, how we don't need much space to maneuver while we are walking, whatever. And in all the old cities, right up to about 1960s, you could see that more or less the human scale was observed. There were spaces of nice proportions. But then after 1960, when the city started to grow and when we started to mechanize building and were able to mass produce big, big buildings, and also when the automobiles came in and we started enormous landscapes which were made to make the cars happy rather than to make the people happy. And in the book, I do much talking about the 5 kilometer or 3 miles an hour which you can find in Venice and in all the old cities, and actually in all the cities where we go on holiday, you can find the people scale, 3 miles an hour scale, While in the suburbs you can find the 50 miles an hour scale where everything is too big and the signs are too large and the buildings are enormous and people feel as if it was made for dinosaurs. What we know now, because there's been done a lot of research in the past decades, all these things are very important for our behavior, for what we like and what we don't like. And it took a while to find out that all these new things which started to happen in the 60s and 70s actually influenced the way we moved about, the way we used to like cities, then we started not to like them anymore. And we found out now more or less what people would like and what would make a nice livable environment and what would not.
And specifically, you talk about how it promotes certain, well, democracy, for example, community, for example, happiness, a sense of safety. You talk about hard edges versus soft edges. What does a hard edge versus a soft edge do to people, and where do we find them?
If you have a linear space like a street, it is a moving space. Psychologically, it signalizes to you, move on, my friend, while the square is organized in such a way that you can see what's happening there, because our eye is organized so that we can overview a space which has a maximum dimensions of about 100 by 100 meters, which we are comfortable with. And when the street starts to be too wide so we can't see the other side properly, and when the squares disappear or starts to be too big, then we don't feel comfortable. In the same way, we don't feel comfortable if we have blank walls or big buildings thundering into the sidewalks with no details. They signalize, move on, my friend, don't stop here. While on the other side, if you have facades which are detailed with many nooks and crannies, as we had in all the old cities, then you feel much more that your body can relate to this facade. And again, there's so much more interest in walking along a string of shops which have some of their merchandise out on the street. So there's smell and color and shapes to look at. And also, I point out that such a thing as the North American porch, where you have in front of your house, you have a space which is private, but lies on the borderland between the private zone, interior, and the public zone, the street. And we have studied this in Australia, in Canada, in Europe, in America. And in all cases, you will find that in those streets, there are much more life than in streets which have what I call hard edges. We can also talk about a come-and-go house, a place where the only thing you can do when you come out is to leave it or jump into your car and get out of the place as fast as you can, as opposed to a place where your children can hang around near the entrance and they can play with other kids, and while groups of kids are forming, then they can move a little bit further out into the grass at the fringes of the street. We know about this called the edge effect, that people love to stay at the edges when they are to spend some time. We have in the dance room, ballroom, we have the wallflowers, all the people sitting around the edges waiting for the activity to start. And when the dancing stops, you hurry out to the edge. You know, when you are at a reception, how you move along the edge. And we also know what I call in the book the piano effect, that you get really happy if moving along the edge, you come to a piano, so you have a friend in this area, so you can lean to this piano, and then you are not alone. You have some solid object. All these details in the physical environment, they function psychologically as supports for you being there and you being comfortable. All this we have had to reinvent and refine through research, because for a long period, the architects really have been trying to make buildings as sleek and as glassy and as closed as possible. Virtually nothing was known about the psychology of man and how people interact with the built environment. In the old days, this was part of the tradition, this was part of all the experience, and throughout the history of man's settlement in urban areas, we have seen all these rules being obeyed because people knew about them out of experience. But when we started to plan in the big way, they threw out all these rules by mistake. Now we have come to a new era where, again, we have a shift of paradigm where we must start again carefully to make our cities and our habitat so that it responds to man. If we do it, we have a more lively and livable environment. We have a more safe environment because if people use the same spaces, they are more safe and they are perceived as more safe, where we can walk more and bicycle more, and also a good public realm and a good public transportation system. They are like brothers and sisters. You have to walk or bicycle to your light rail, and you have in the other end of the journey to move to your office or your workplace. And finally, we have come to realize that we must make cities which invite people to use their own muscles in their daily day. We will do whatever we can to make the city in such a way that it invites people to walk and bicycle as much as possible, because this kind of policy actually addresses all these important issues. And that's why you can find, say, in New York, this policy that they would like to make it more attractive to walk. They would like to make better public spaces where people can sit down and enjoy each other, enjoy looking at the life of the city. And they also have a policy of introducing bicycle lanes so that you can get around in the city by subway and by bicycle and by walking, and more or less make the use of, or the forced use of, automobiles unnecessary. That means that they have this policy of making a society which is not so dependent on automobiles. And other cities like Copenhagen, we've reached a long way along these lines. Already now in Copenhagen, 37% of all commuting to work is done on bicycles, on an excellent bicycle lane system which covers the whole city and makes it faster and more comfortable and very safe to bicycle. A lot of people do it, and more people do it every year. Melbourne and Sydney are also into this kind of policies. So is Vancouver. So you can see cities from one end of the world to the other start to address this issue that we will have to make cities which are much more people-friendly.
You were talking about what you've done in Copenhagen, and one of the things that I understand was there is where you put the bike lanes that created a sense of safety for bicycle riders. Could you explain what you have done there?
In my city here in Copenhagen, they look upon bike lanes just in the same way as sidewalks. We have this old tradition in cities that in front, along all buildings, there shall be a sidewalk, so you can walk all over the city. And they actually treat bike lanes in the same way. So next to the sidewalk, they have the bike lane. And that means that the system of bike lanes almost reach every single door in the city. And then the parked cars are placed on the outside of the bike lane so that the parked cars protect the bicycles. And this is also called Copenhagen-style bike lanes. In many cities, I've seen, of course, a system where you have the parked cars next to the sidewalk, and then you have painted some stripes on the outside of the parked cars and put some bicycle symbols. That means that the bicyclists are to protect the parked cars, which, of course, is much more dangerous than the other system where you put the bike lanes next to the sidewalk and inside the parked cars. A very important part in the bicycle systems, which we see in Holland and Denmark and other places, are that the intersections are the place which is really dangerous in a bicycle system. And say in Copenhagen, we have special bike crossings, like we have pedestrian crossings. We have special lights for bicycles, which comes out, which turns green before the light for the cars, so the bicycles can get across before the cars even think of starting after the red light. All this makes it much, much safer to bicycle than it was previously. And also in Copenhagen, bicycling is a way to go around. It is not anymore an extreme sport for young males between 25 and 35 on Tour de France bikes and in full survival gear. In Copenhagen, it's every generation, from my grandchildren of 6, 7, bicycling to school, to myself, who is in my 70s, and my wife, who who bicycle a lot because it's safe and practical for all generations. And we are doing it on just ordinary upright bicycles. Because of all the people bicycling and all the age groups, the bicycle speed is not very high. It is about 15 to 20 kilometers, as opposed to the very fast couriers who go twice as fast and is a danger for everybody, including themselves.
There are other things that normally people would not connect to design of a city that you connect. And one of them is a design that promotes democratic expression. How can a city be designed in a way that promotes democratic expression?
We can close our eyes and think of a city where no people visit outdoors, where most of the life is going on indoors in front of computers and goods are delivered and information you get about the surroundings you get through the television. So you all the time see pictures of what other people have seen here and there, as opposed to another city where, as part of your daily day pattern, you move about in streets where your neighbors also move about, or your fellow students or your workmates. We know from crime prevention studies that it's a very good crime prevention strategy to make sure that there are people in the streets and let people from different groups in society naturally meet each other and realize that there are many different types of people, many age groups, many cultural groups and ethnic groups in society, and the vast majority are nice and wonderful people, which you can identify yourself with these. And we know that it's very important for the feeling of safety and friendliness in a neighborhood that you have this chance to meet your people in the course of your day. And also, I do think that it's a very important thing for the whole notion of democracy that we can meet our fellow citizens, and also that we have public forum where we can express our viewpoints or express our moods towards each other. I know that in the American Constitution, you have in the very First Amendment this rule that everybody has the right to, I think it's address your fellow citizens in the public forum.
The right to assemble?
Yeah, the right to assemble. And it captures very much this thing that if there is no public forum and that you have all your information about society is controlled and piped to you, then you get a very distorted picture of the society and your neighborhood and your city. And basically, you generally get quite scared about what is out there. In other cities like Melbourne and Copenhagen, where they have this policy of getting people out on the streets as much as possible and out of the cars, you have this feeling of a much friendlier city, a city of people instead of a city of noise and fumes and automobiles maybe. But I certainly think that a people-friendly city can also have automobiles to serve a number of the needs, and we can have coexistence. But we have been for many years too observant to the needs of the automobiles, and we have neglected the needs of the human beings. My book is very much about getting a better balance here. In 1961, a very famous American journalist, Jane Jacobs, in New York, wrote a book called The Life and Death of Great American Cities, where she pointed out that with this big speed in modern city planning and the invasion of the motor car, that if the modern city planners and the traffic planners came to rule the cities, the great cities would be dead cities. And she was absolutely right. But it has taken us about 50 years really to find all about this and try to turn the supertanker around. And now it is very interesting to see in many, many cities, they are full speed into making much more people-friendly cities, having realized that the other model was not too smart in the long run.
So suppose you were going to take a city that is very sprawled out, like Los Angeles, that is definitely built around the automobile.
I know.
And it's congested, although they're converting the downtown into more of a walkable city. It still obviously needs considerable work. What would you recommend for those kinds of cities, particularly in the U.S., the Midwestern cities, a lot of them are like that, Middle America, Los Angeles. Where would city designers, architects, and planners start?
That's a little tall order here in the little radio program to solve the problems of mankind. I think if I could answer your question, there's really a market out there. But maybe we can start with New York, because New York is, of course, not like the other American cities, but it's amazing what Mayor Michael Bloomberg and his staff achieved in just 3 years in pouring out bicycle lanes, in widening the sidewalks, in turning greater parts of Broadway into a boulevard with great sidewalks, in closing Broadway to traffic and creating a rather fabulous public spaces on Herald Square and Times Square, Madison Square, Union Square, and see all the changes this has made to New York in just 3 years. This is amazing. But I know that the fabric in New York is not this fabric of sprawl. But I could take the example of Melbourne. In Melbourne, they are 3 million people, and they realize that in span of 20, 30 years, they need to find room for another 3 million. And they have made a complete plan of how they can double the population without spreading the city further by building up not high density, but medium density along the railway lines and the tram lines and the public transportation lines. In this way, they could, leaving 90% of all the suburbs alone, but they could have then bands of denser urban fabric built around good public transportation services. And also these bands will have a number of other services. They will have cultural services, and that will help everyone in the suburbs, because now they will have much closer to services than they have. And there are plans for this in a number of places, and in some places they are full speed doing it, like in Brisbane and in Sydney. They also have this notion of the city of villages. Frankly speaking, it is not very easy, because we have spread out enormously over the past 30, 40 years. Every problem you mention, there's always one or two places in the world where they have found a solution. And the trick is very much to find out where the solutions are for this problem or the other, to show examples from all 5-6 continents.
Well, thank you so very much, Dr. Jan Gehl, for joining us here.
You're most welcome.
Dr. Jan Gehl is Professor Emeritus of Urban Design at the School of Architecture in Copenhagen, Denmark. He's the author of the book Cities for People and an award-winning architect. And that is it for this week's edition of the Scholar Circle. Many thanks to everybody who makes this show possible. Ankin Agassian, Melissa Chiprin, Khwatemok Aleman, and our webmaster, Sad Dongre. Most of all, thank you for listening. Please be sure to like us on Facebook and to follow us on Twitter at Armudian. If you missed a part of the show, you can always get them from the KPFK archives or from our own archives, scholarcircle.org. We'll see you next week.